You are listening to Radio Albion.
Hello everyone, welcome to another edition of the Orthodox Nationalist. This is Matthew Raphael Johnson. Today is the 11th of December, 2019. And as always, I want to begin by thanking my donors and my friends and supporters. I have some new medical issues that I'm dealing with. These are dental problems with my gums. So any pennies that you could, you can give, I would appreciate. This has to do with stress, actually, extreme recession of the gums connected with stress as it turns out. Anyway, we're not here to talk about depressing things today. We're going to talk about something positive. And that is that we are at, or almost at, the 30th anniversary of the removal of Nicolae Ceaușescu from Romania and his execution on New Calendar Christmas Day, 1989. This was the event that had me leave my career as a musician and get involved in political science, political theory, and history. Watching his trial on TV and being executed, where just a few months before, he was seen as immovable. That really goes for the whole Soviet system, but for some reason, his execution and the violence that occurred in the cities of Romania 30 years ago changed my life. And it's been one hell of a 30 years. So we're not just talking about the 30-year anniversary of the removal and execution of Ceaușescu, but also the 30-year anniversary of me doing this stuff, for better or for worse, full time. After I saw his body laying there, I changed my major. I remember the very day. So this was the event 30 years ago. Now there are some who claim that there were factions of the Communist Party. Of course, they're the only politically active party there who supported this. Ceaușescu had many enemies. Securitate, his security police were some of the most efficient in the Eastern Bloc. The Stasi may have been a little bit better, but by the time this occurred, they had at least 13,000 active agents and about 500,000 informers in a population of 22 million people. The Securitate also had a 20,000-strong elite infantry force with heavy weapons, helicopters, and everything else. They had their own private army, as did the KGB. So this wasn't just a police force. This also was an elite infantry unit, and they were taken from other parts of the military and brought into the security police. And, of course, they were promoted not just based on their ability, but also on their loyalty to the system. Ceaușescu really ruled starting from 1965 or 67. He took over the State Council in 67. And, of course, until Christmas Day of 1989. The tremendous growth, where Romania was known for tremendous economic growth in the 50s, 60s, and 70s. Even parts of the 80s, unlike other places, that just meant higher debt because it meant higher spending and more borrowing. And that led to the austerity program being imposed by the IMF. The Romanian communists had to go and borrow from. You're talking about $10 billion debt in the early 80s. That's odd that a communist movement would have to go borrow from the IMF, the Western bankers. I thought they were enemies. But we'll find out here in a minute that, of course, that growth came from the West. Western corporations built Romania, as they did all communist countries. With the violence in the camps and the mass murder that the communists were involved in, this did not bother the West at all. As always, the stress was on heavy industry. So you have these gigantic enterprises that may or may not have had any relationship to actually what Romania needed, but this is what was used. So the last credit from the IMF came in 1981, and one of the things that they demanded was a massive increase in exports in order to pay down this debt. The problem was, in 1989, the debt was repaid, which is rare enough, but the austerity remained. The price of repaying that debt was extraordinary because the man sold everything that wasn't nailed down, and this was his downfall. The 1980s, prices went through the roof. 1982, they went up 55% just that year. Gas went up 150% in 1982, between 81 and 82, 83. At the same time, social spending had collapsed. There was a 40% decrease in housing investment in that period of time. So you went from this explosive economic growth, 50s, 60s, and most of the 70s, to a complete collapse immediately afterwards. He began to ration everything. And my favorite program was called the Rational Eating Program. See, the communists can never admit when they're wrong. They have to claim that their damage control somehow was always part of the plan. So when he was cutting down the rations given to the population, he couldn't say that, well, this is because our economies are rational. No, it's because we're worried about the health of the population. We want you people to eat better and eat less to become thinner. So it was called a rational eating program. But everything was rationed, including energy. You know, Romania is a large oil producer, but of course that was going mostly to the Soviet Union, as well as being sold to the West. They weren't using any of that in Romania. So they're importing energy, for a country that's more than self-sufficient in it. And of course, since they've been in the EU, there is no difference here. So you went from massive growth to a very rapid collapse. But by 1989, the population had had enough, and things were happening in Eastern Europe that Americans didn't understand. We were being told that the CIA was telling us that the Soviet bloc was rock solid, that they're going to make their switch to light industry and consumer goods very soon. We should join with them in this. The anti-communist West, of course, always supporting coexistence with the communist movement. Not with nationalist governments, though. They have to be destroyed. Communist ones, never sanctions on any of these. But there, you had something called the Letter of the Six. A Jewish communist named Shlomo Brokhan, who, of course, organized this. And he wouldn't have been able to organize this without a Securitate faction supporting him. The Letter of the Six was a letter from Communist Party members to Ceausescu. It's really kind of a silly thing, because they're accusing him of deviance from the Constitution, as if constitutional concerns were a big deal in a dictatorship. The Constitution is, that's a bourgeois instrument. They didn't believe in constitutions. But even guys like Brokhan himself, you know, he became a professor of public policy, and he never went to college. You know, he has no right to criticize people like Elena when he was doing the same kind of thing. But of course, they were attacking the austerity program, and they were attacking the austerity program even when the debt had been repaid. One of the things that they complained about was forced labor on Sundays. Because for some reason, the atheist constitution had as a right a day off on Sundays. And one of the big issues is something called systemization. Systemization is an odd term for the merger of small towns in the countryside with cities. Now, Marxism has always been a Jewish urban movement, and they both admire and despise the farmers in the small towns. Well, Ceausescu called small towns irrational, especially if they were under 1,000 people. Systemization was one of the great evils that that not only the letter of the six, but eventually Ceausescu's trial will bring up. This is essentially rural resettlement, integration of small towns into the cities. Small towns were essentially destroyed along with their old style architecture. This was a way to destroy the church in many ways. It's a dissolution of the old villages and everything about them. This was a mass demolition of the old architecture of the Romanian countryside and connecting them and bringing them into these huge megacities. Now, and including creating new megacities in the countryside as they consolidate these small towns with their new architecture and their new secular way of life backed by the United States. U.S. investment was pouring into Romania during this period of time, the anti-communist West. And then after 1981, though, he wanted these new supervillages to be self-sufficient. But self-sufficiency was very much a part of his agenda. He wanted Romania to be self-sufficient. He wanted Romania, as such, to be a great power. Otherwise, the letter of the six deals with the fact that he forbade contact with foreigners, which is also unconstitutional, or so they said. They said that planning had failed, that factories lack raw materials, they lack skilled labor. They complained about the forced assimilation of minorities, Hungarians, Gypsies, Jews, and given Brokan was a Jew, it's probably, you know, he's really talking about Jews more than anything else. And, of course, there was a huge, the Civic Center in Bucharest, which was a gigantic, I think it's one of the largest civic buildings in the world, this gigantic white elephant, which is really an ego boost to the party and to Ceausescu personally, that this was all simply a waste of time, that no one really got anything out of it. And then they say, finally, that Ceausescu is becoming isolated, which economically was not the case. Western investment kept coming into the country, but because of the blatant abuses of the population, which no one denies anymore, countries were removing their embassies from Romania. Whether that was because of Ceausescu or not is another matter. But by this period of time, of course, the economic community, which would soon become the EU, had cut off its credits to the Romanian government. So essentially, they're the three main evils, or the letter of the six that really electrified Communist Party members, was systemization, the breakdown of basic freedoms and rights, and the fact of massive export of the country's food and energy when they in fact needed it in Romania. Now, there's plenty of people who realize that there was always an anti-Ceausescu faction. Ceausescu was, and his wife were from a poor family in the village. They were seen like Khrushchev was seen in the Soviet Union as a yokel. So there was always a faction against him. The military always had a problem with him because he was never a military man. The military was always close to the Soviet Union. And equipment was very poor. It was never an important part of the Warsaw Pact. It was never really an important part of Soviet foreign policy. And I know this from several friends of mine one friend of mine, who was in the Romanian army, said that they were simply used for labor. They got very poor equipment, and they were used for labor when, you know, things needed to be done in the fields, whatever it is, and there weren't enough people. Systemization, of course, destroyed the harvest. Now they needed food more than ever, and in some cases the army was used to fill those gaps. But the big evil was this massive rationing. Of all the electricity used in Romania, the end of the 1980s, only 5% was used for households, which is ridiculously low. I mean, the price of oil had gone through the roof. Remember, Romania is an important oil producer. And most of this stuff is being delivered below market prices to the Soviets. So they can't even benefit from that. And what everyone knew, but no one talked about, was the fact that the private sector was feeding the country. It was private plots in private markets at the local level that was really producing the food. Because Ceausescu's policy was, he was increasing the quotas that farmers needed to bring to the state, and they were paying a full third, only a third of the market price. And this is because of systemization, the destruction of small towns, the destruction of the farm culture. And despite that he created this huge network of canals and irrigation projects, thinking that that actually mattered, doesn't make any difference when the village system has been destroyed. Peasants are rounded up and brought into the cities to work in these gigantic industrial combines. And they wonder why they don't have enough food. But not to worry, the United States was going to take care of this. But the military was close to the Soviet Union. Again, not a giant part of the Warsaw Pact. But because of that, you had a sense that the military was a part of the overthrow of Ceausescu 30 years ago. And even, you know, being Gorbachev had no problem with the state that took over after December of 89, the National Salvation Front. So, again, massive growth. You know, between 51 and 74, the average growth of GDP was 12%. This is extraordinary. Between 55 and 85, a 200% increase in wages. That's controlling for inflation. And a growth of, again, controlling for inflation, 20% of new housing. Of course, a lot of that had to do with the destruction of the old housing, systemization. So a lot of this growth really is taking the place of something that was unnecessarily destroyed in the first place. And of course, because he was concerned with self-sufficiency, at least rhetorically, he was engaging in import substitution. He was involved in exports, but not so much in imports. Import substitution is most economists hate it, but it's a rational nationalist concept where whatever it is that you can make at home that you don't need from abroad, you make at home. Which is something, you know, the Soviets kind of, you know, didn't like, but that's a separate issue. He created a new rail system that wasn't quite finished, but he wanted to do this on Romanian terms, although most of the capital came from the West. 45% of Romanian trade was done with non-communist countries. Now let's make it clear here. When this was going on, I heard from every commentator that Ceausescu was anti-Soviet, that he created his own foreign policy. Well, it's simply not true. The only thing really he did is that he opposed the Soviet invasion of Czechoslovakia in 1968. And he did not participate in that. Of course, the answer to that is that, well, he didn't ask. He wasn't asked. East Germany didn't participate either. Most of the Warsaw Pact was against it. You had a giant faction in the Soviet Union who was against it. That doesn't mean anything. The Soviets knew that he was making a gambit for popularity to create this so-called national communism, which he never did. And so when he was overthrown, you had this theory that the Soviets were a big part of this. And it's simply not the case. He was not irritating to the Soviet Union. Everything that he did that was anti-Soviet was purely symbolic. So when he was overthrown, commentators were claiming that this was either, it's possible that this was a Soviet coup, or at the very least, they were saying that he was independent of the Soviet Union and he irritated them, and this is why the U.S. supported Romania. Well, there's a lot wrong with this. There was never, he was never kicked out of the Warsaw Pact. He was never kicked out of the Soviet orbit. They never put any sanctions on Romania. It was purely rhetorical. There was very little anti-Soviet that Ceausescu ever did. He was pro-Soviet most of his career. But his notion of this national patriotism was about building his own power base, had nothing to do with Marxism, had nothing to do with the Soviet Union. But the investment that poured into Romania was then shared with and benefited the USSR. So, economically speaking, the debt began to grow when the growth began to slow in 1977. A massive debt to the IMF banks, and IMF is just, that's a consortium of banks, nothing more than that. But he put, you know, repayment as the same thing as independence. He even positioned himself as the dictator against the banks as he's borrowing from them. But in 1970, you had a 17% growth rate in Romania. The growth rate in Western Europe was 0.8%. Late 70s, again, 26% growth, but inflation was at 11%. Soon, though, you're going to get negative. Between 87 and 88, you had a massive drop. And after Ceausescu was overthrown, in 1991, you had a drop of 12% of GDP. And in 1992, almost 10% of GDP. Industry was where he was going to make his mark. In 1971, he had about 11% growth. 73, 40%. 79, 9%. But in 1982, negative 17. So this is extremely volatile. It depended on what was happening at the moment, economically speaking. Now, fixed capital formation is one of the best economic markers. This is actually new things being built, new capital being set up on the ground. Fixed capital formation is an accurate depiction of economic growth. 1971, it was 14%, or 15% actually. 74, it was 21%, but in 1980, you get negative 36%. In agriculture, again, because of systemization, by 1975, you had zero growth. But by 1980 and beyond, you had the slow collapse of the agricultural sector and, of course, the food sector. But exports, of course, grew in the early 70s by 420%. And this is a problem. Trying to make Romania self-sufficient. But there was never a time where he said, I'm going to detach Romania from the Warsaw Pact or from the Soviet trading bloc. He never said this. He never said this whatsoever. But what he was doing is setting himself up for Western investment. The Johnson administration, Nixon administration backed Romanian communism 100%. All the abuses, all the violence in Romania was ignored, and American capitalists poured into Romania. Nixon gave Ceausescu most favored nation status. Right? This is during the Cold War. Supposed to be enemies with the Eastern Bloc, right? And even when banks didn't want to lend, Richard Nixon personally demanded that they lend to Romania, personally interceded for Ceausescu. But the problem was, and of course the Americans knew this, that Romanian factories were not putting out products that Americans wanted. Even by the Nixon administration, the productive capacity of Western Europe was so overwhelmingly powerful, Westerners couldn't buy everything that was being created. What the heck did they need from Romania? But the Nixon administration in particular, giving them most favored nation status shows you the connection between American capital and the Eastern Bloc. There was no sanctions on Romania from the Soviets. They weren't enemies. Therefore, any benefit to Romania automatically goes to the USSR. But most favored nation status, that means sensitive information was being sent there. I thought the U.S. was at war with the Soviet Union. I mean, I could see if they had separated themselves from the Warsaw Pact and even tried to go it alone. I could see that, but there was never a single breach between Ceausescu and the Soviets. These were purely symbolic rhetorical acts from 1968, and that was pretty much it. But he justified it by saying that Romania is independent of the Soviet Union and cited 1968 as his sole bit of evidence. The other reason, of course, in Nixon's mind was he was able to communicate with the Chinese via Romania. One of the things, the other things that the Romanians did that irritated the Soviets is that they rejected the Sino-Soviet split of 1961, and rejected the rejection of the Chinese. Again, Romanian opinion on China wasn't very significant in Moscow. These are purely symbolic acts. Now, I'm looking at an intelligence memorandum from the CIA in 1972, recently declassified. And again, Ceausescu was being spoken to like an honored guest, like a friend, like an ally. And of course, the main issue from the Americans is that he permit the emigration of Romanian Jews to Israel. That's the big deal. They note that trade with the West from Romania is about 45% of their total, which is very high, highest of all in the Warsaw Pact. That was pretty much the nature of this memorandum. And the notion that, you know, the economy will grow and the Western world will benefit from Romanian products, which never happened. They don't say anything about Romanian oil going to the Soviets. They don't say anything about, you know, separating themselves from the Warsaw Pact or anything like that. This is simply two friends talking. Now, in 1977, Ion Pacepa defected to the West. Pacepa was the highest-ranking defector from Romania. He was a general in the Securitate Police. Now, he's an interesting figure, partially because in 77, he was telling the West of all the things that were going on in Romania, but that didn't in the least affect the flow of capital and investment to that country. The problem with Pacepa, he's still alive. He's 91 years old. Ceausescu put, a $2 million bounty on his head for anyone to kill him. He's one of these, like most defectors, you have to be very careful what he says. It was not a huge issue in 77. This was not heavily covered by the press. And Pacepa he says some very questionable things. He was all in favor of the Iraq invasion, for example, saying that the Soviets had created the nuclear industry in Iraq. And we need to get in there and stop it. He says that the Soviets were engaged in anti-Semitic propaganda against Israel in the Middle East, that Pius XII was a Nazi sympathizer, and everyone in the intelligence community knew that. He claimed that Lee Harvey Oswald was, in fact, recruited by the KGB to kill JFK, and Nikita Khrushchev was one of the people who was involved with that. Jack Ruby was also a Soviet agent and was asked to kill Oswald in order to silence him. And in fact, he accepts the Warren Commission as fact. So you got to be careful. And this is the case with all defectors. He also claimed that Ceausescu was going to assassinate, you know, most of the leadership of Eastern Europe. And I think some of the anti-Soviet claims against Ceausescu comes from Pacepa, that he was going to kill Imre Nagy, for example. or I'm sorry, that the Kremlin had already killed, that tried to kill people like, you know, Dej and Inaj and Ruslansky and the Shah of Iran and everything else, and even Mao Zedong. So this is, you know, and there was a lot of people who said, you know, maybe this guy isn't the most reliable person in the world. I'm sorry, he defected in 1978. But of course, his defection didn't affect anything. He sold a lot of books. And allegedly he destroyed, his defection destroyed much of the Securitate, intelligence organization in Western Europe, since this was very much his creation. So much of the propaganda that Ceausescu was this anti-Soviet agent, comes from Pasipa. And it simply isn't the case. Especially when, you know, Nixon gives him MFN, a few years earlier. So, Pasipa is not someone to be listened to, but he wasn't even a cause celeb in this country. Now, briefly, I want to talk about Elena. Elena has always been, fascinating for me. She was Nikolai's wife and was more than just the first lady. After they visited China, she noticed that Mao's wife had a great degree of political power, and that got her very excited. And she wanted to have a cult of personality in her own right, and that's exactly what she did. There's quite a bit written on her, both in Russian and in English. She only had a fifth grade education. But one of my favorite claims is that she claimed to be a PhD in chemistry. She tried to go to high school at one point, was kicked out for cheating. But in 1957, she was made a fellow of the National Institute for Chemical Research in Romania. And of course, once Ceausescu takes over the party a few years later, she's claiming to be the first scientist and first chemist of the nation. But she couldn't even pronounce the Romanian pronunciation for CO2, carbon dioxide. And she didn't even understand that. Now, you know, I've criticized academia quite a bit on my show and in my life. And how academic institutions in the West supported Elena is just one more thing to show exactly how ridiculous these institutions are. The Western academic establishment took her seriously as a chemist and as an academic, claiming that in the Soviet bloc, women are equal to men. You see, you have a PhD in chemistry here who came from a village. The woman who won the Nobel Prize in chemistry, Dorothy Hodgkin, in Great Britain would rhapsodize about Elena's abilities as a scholar and academic, that she was an outstanding example of women in science, the Royal Institute of Chemistry, the Polytechnic of Central London, gushed and went on about her academic achievements. Same thing for Sir Richard Norman, who was the president of the Institute at the time. Just went on and on and on about this. But everyone knew that she only had a fifth grade education. Everyone knew that other people wrote her papers for her. But this is how, this guy by the name of Richard Clegg, an English academic, wrote about this in his own work on academic corruption. That because she was female and from a left-wing country, or a left-wing government, they gushed and gushed and gushed about her. She would never talk about it. Of course, because she was very modest, not because she was ignorant. She was always a very unpopular figure in Romania, despite the propaganda, the persona, they created these characters with her in it, the peasant, the educator, the working woman, the chemist, the doctor, all of this stuff. And it never quite worked in Romania. And I've seen her dissertation cited in Western academic journals, well into the 60s. Again, it simply shows you how ridiculous the Western academic establishment is. Unfortunately, unlike people like Evita Peron, the poor woman was very unattractive. So her personality cult didn't really take off like Evita's did, and that caused her a great amount of jealousy and resentment. In other words, if Ceausescu had died, I'm trying to say here, Ceausescu had died in the late 70s, he may have been treated in history as a very successful ruler. Again, nothing he did was anti-Soviet. He had these symbolic speeches that he'd make once in a while, and that was about it. What happened was, when the energy crisis hits, and it hit the West hard because the Romanian economy was connected with the West, it hit Romania hard. And the fact is that the growth in the economy came from Western investment. It didn't come from Romania as such. Also, there was a massive earthquake in 1977, a drought right after World War II. But the 77 earthquake was also something that didn't quite get the attention of the Armenian earthquake a decade later. But he may have had some popularity, but Elena never did. But you had a massive growth in industry, fixed capital formation, but also the growth in debt and borrowing from the IMF. And much of this was done because in making believe that he was anti-Soviet, he was getting tons of credits and investment from Western banks. And of course, the key fact is, because there was no sanctions on Romania, anything invested in Romania would go to the Soviet Union. And Nixon would say that, well, this is because, he's an independent communist. But of course, they had full free trade with the USSR. This is how the Americans were able to trade with the Soviets so briskly and the Chinese is by using Romania, among other things. So the economy stalls. A lot of the 1980s, depending on the sector. The debt was paid back at the cost of shipping everything in the country overseas. And this was his undoing. The revolution began in earnest in, almost exactly 30 years ago. It's interesting that the Securitate was placed under army control on December 4th. At the time when this was going on 30 years ago, I remember the claim was from so-called Romania experts. So the army has sided with the people. The security police has sided with the dictator. And this simply isn't true. Again, largely because Securitate was placed under army control, which no one knew at the time. Now, by the 22nd of December, the chain of command had fallen apart entirely. The truth is that the shooting of the population came from the army. It did not come from the Securitate police. But by the 17th of December, Ceausescu knew that a coup was almost inevitable. And he began putting, even months earlier than this, began putting family members in key positions of power. Now, the efficient cause, not the ultimate cause, the efficient cause of the revolution was the imprisonment of a Hungarian minister by the name of László Tokes. I don't know how to pronounce that, some crazy Hungarian name. T-O-K-E-S. Who was anti-Ceausescu, anti-systemization. He was a Protestant, and he was going to be deported. And because of this, there was protests, and these protests became riots, and these riots became a revolution. There was 20,000 people in revolt by December 18th. And it was the rural resettlement program that was a center of his concern. But by the 20th of December, the army had already sided with the protesters, which in Timisoara was already about 50,000. And as always, despite the so-called nationalism of Ceausescu's public pronouncements, Romania had become internationalized. Just as a quick example, the irrigation projects I mentioned came from British companies. The natural gas state concern was created by the Germans. The nitro phosphate plant came from the Americans. This is, And so this was not a national communist by any, Renault, the car manufacturer, had a plant from France in Romania. So this was an internationalized economy. The Western firms that were heavily invested, Anderson Oil, Pepsi, and I should have mentioned this before, but the bank that ultimately, backed all of this was the, Consolidated Bank and Trust of Illinois. So December 20th, 30 years ago, the city of Timisoara was one of the first to go up in revolt, and they wrote the Timisoara Declaration on December 20th. It's an interesting document, and one of the things it says, this isn't just a demonstration for Laszlo. It's not a demonstration against Ceausescu. This is an anti-communist demonstration. This isn't just against Ceausescu. They say that all social classes are involved here. This isn't a working class thing or an upper class thing. And they attack the Marxist idea of class rule. Not that the Marxists ever actually believed that, but they said when you divide the country into classes, it's a divide and rule thing. It makes a country easy for elites to rule. But unfortunately, rule is also based on classes. But what they're talking about is how the Communist Party stayed in power for so long. Then they also said this is a multinational revolution. It's not just Hungarians. It's also Romanians and German citizens living in Romania. Then, of course, in order to get Western support, I guess they must have been ignorant about how heavily the Westerners were invested in this. They said all parties, there should be free elections and all parties should be permitted except extremist ones. I'm not sure what they meant by that. They did want to ban the Communist Party because of everything, you know. He said the bureaucrats that have been ruling for the last 45 years already have an edge in any electoral contest, so they shouldn't be permitted to to be a part of any new democracy here. They also say that this isn't a strike for higher wages. This isn't about, you know, you had the big miner strike in 1977. It's not that. This is beyond that. This is a matter of ideals, not just, you know, we want better working conditions, we want better, easier political system. They say, well, you know, high wages would mean inflation. They said, in order to have real high wages, we have to produce something that people want. So it suggests to me that this declaration wasn't written by ordinary citizens. This was a serious piece of work. Whether it was the Securitate faction, or whether this was a Western intelligence operative, whoever it may have been, this is a pretty sophisticated piece of paper. An interesting thing that they say is that the planned economy had failed completely, like the Letter of the Six had mentioned. And again, the Letter of the Six had electrified the country, or at least the party. But they say that we believe in private property. We don't believe in capitalism. And this was a kind of a backhand against the Western investment in the country. You know, Pepsi was very prominent in this. They wanted privatization of state projects, but to be able to sell the stock to employees at an equal distribution. And what's interesting, something they say is that exiles, or those who have left the country when they return to rebuild Romania, should not be attacked. Now, I know for a fact, I have a friend of mine who had this problem, that there was an attack on those who left the country when they returned. And they say here, you know, there's not one of us who didn't want to leave at one time or another. We can't judge these people. We need everyone back. Because, you know, unfortunately, the people who get up and leave are often the best, most energetic people, the country that could least afford to lose. But people don't remember that the government that took over, the National Salvation Front government, that took over even before Ceausescu's execution, this was a pro-Gorbachev movement. This was a one-party state. And the new government, you know, yes, there was shooting in the streets. You had several thousand killed. But this new government in 1990, you know, in the presidential election got 85% of the vote. In 1992, they got just over 10%. I'm sorry, just over, not under 5%, actually. The legislature, they got about 10%. That's how quickly this new government collapsed in the eyes of the population. And you had people thinking that maybe Ceausescu wasn't so bad, because a few decades earlier, you had massive economic growth, and now this is continuing the collapse that Ceausescu had brought into existence. They inherited this problem, not they didn't create it. But there were riots. You had dissidents against the new government. You had riots in January of 1990 into February. And then in June of 1990, the government, the National Salvation Government, had a bright idea to bring in the miners from the mining regions of the country and use those guys as thugs to beat up the anti-government riots. And I'm telling you something, these are tough guys. They were bussed in, and I know this for a fact, I know people who were there. Bringing the miners in to beat the crap out of these guys was frightening. The miners generally supported, or at least they said they supported, the National Salvation Front, which was a reformist communist movement. But as this is going on, inflation had reached about 128%. In 1991, a collapse of 12% of the economy. Agriculture was gone. And the drop in GDP from 90 to 91, I'm sorry, yeah, from 90 to 91 was, it went from 184 billion to 171 billion. So you had these massive drops in just the worth of the country. In 1991, inflation even went up to 161%. The next year, it was 210%. And that's just, you know, one estimate. And whatever investment from the West, all of a sudden investment from the West dries up because the new government brought in miners to beat up the opposition. They had no problem trading with Ceausescu. But because of this, all of a sudden now they're tyrants. The president at the time was Ionulescu, who would never prosecute any of these guys. I remember as the revolution was taking place, you had the heads of both the army and the Securitate working together. I mean, they were hostages, but allegedly that they had switched sides and were now working for the revolution. General Vlad for the Securitate and General Gusha for the army. Now this is where it gets foggy, because neither one of these guys were off the phone during this period of time. They're shooting out in the streets. No one could quite tell who's shooting what. General Vlad from the Securitate is on the phone, hearing what the head of the army is saying, and is telling his friends where to go and where to be, based on what the head of the army was saying. In other words, he's hearing what he's saying on the phone and then telling his soldiers to go fight him. Now, how this took 2 days for anyone to notice this was going on is a mystery. They were all right there. They were all in the same room. So there has to be some kind of foul play going on here. You have the two heads of these organizations in the same room on the phone for 2 days, giving orders, talking to the media and everything else. And the head of the security police is giving his soldiers orders based on what he hears the army general saying. So the Securitate always knew what the army was going to do. And it took 2 days to figure this out. They're all in the same damn office. You know, if you look right on YouTube, there's videos of these guys doing this. It's a really bizarre thing. And of course, most people have the point of view that, you know, these were elite factions just simply wanting to get rid of Ceausescu. But once Ceausescu goes, now you have a problem with the different factions fighting each other. Then you have the trial. The trial, it was hard to watch. I just rewatched it again on YouTube, and there's one that has English subtitles. There's no way that this was a legitimate trial. Now, it's not as if anyone knew that Ceausescu, you know, wasn't deserving of capital punishment. No one denied that. But it was a kangaroo court. The trial lasted about 15 minutes. The accusations were mostly the people being killed in the streets now were being killed on their orders, as if you know, the last, you know, since 1967 wasn't enough. They said that people are living on 200 grams a day of food while they lived in luxury. Now, food was rationed. They couldn't figure out why, because the debt had been repaid. And it's true that Ceausescu lived in luxury. They accused him of genocide. They accused him of attacks on the people, you know, using the military to destroy protesters, systemization or the destruction of buildings, destruction of the old architecture, and undermining the economy. And interestingly enough, attacking the soul of the nation, which they said over and over again. Now, Ceausescu's sitting there, says, I don't recognize this court. This is just a coup. You're foreign agents. I recognize only the National Assembly. They said this over and over and over again. Then the Ceausescus were accused of taking babies from orphanages and raising them to become elite Securitate officers. I don't know if this is true or not, but it sounds untrue. But this is one of the things that they were explicitly accused of, and they laughed at that. One thing about the trial, and I didn't know this at the time, is that the accusations that were being barked at Elena and Nikolai came from a book called Red Horizons, which was written by a man we've already talked about, Ion Papisha. Pacepa, the Securitate general who defected. His book, Red Horizons, actually, you know, were all over, you know, in the black market in Romania. And when they were sentenced to death, the accusations came word for word from Red Horizons. And then the second edition of the book, which was published in March 1990, the transcript of the Ceausescu trial was included in it as a way to say this was a book that brought them down. And it had been serialized. And they say it was an important part of overthrowing the Ceausescu government. It says so, at least in the back cover of the book. And it was republished in 29 countries, made into a movie in Hungary. And because of, you know, who this man was, it was a tremendous, but these accusations, allegedly, no, I have not read the book. These accusations come word for word from Red Horizons. Pacepa's work. This is one of the reasons I mentioned him in the first place. Now, because he didn't accept the court, he didn't attempt to defend himself. And we all know what happened. They didn't say anything, so they were tied up, even though they yelled, saying that we'll go out voluntarily, and they went and they were shot in the courtyard. The soldier that did that is, you know, they had a regular firing squad. They put their rifles on automatic so they wouldn't miss, which is odd because it was such close range. I don't know what that meant exactly, but it's a silly thing to say. But I think they wanted an automatic so you wouldn't know which one actually killed them. Even though it was a very popular thing, they asked the soldiers that were present who would like to do the shooting, and they all volunteered. Now, I would be remiss if I didn't mention the role of the Orthodox Church in this. And I really wanted to avoid the issue because it's so depressing. We know that the Orthodox Church, that is to say, the human, you know, institutional part of the church, supported these governments in these countries. You know, these bishops were all chosen because they supported or could be counted on to support the communist government. You only had three patriarchs in this period of time. Patriarch Justinian, who was an actual member of the party before he became a bishop. Patriarch Teosist, or Pashu. And then in between those two was Patriarch Justin. So you had three relatively long-lived patriarchs. All three had that one thing in common. is that they, without question and without doubt and without the slightest deviation, supported the communist government. Patriarch Justinian, however, was a member of the party beforehand. The reason he became patriarch was that when the first dictator of communist Romania, George Udej, had escaped from an internment camp in 1944, it was Justinian who hid him in a village. Didn't know who he was, but he hid him from the police. When Dej takes over the government, Patriarch Justinian, of course, is going to have a very good career ahead of him. And it's the reason that Justinian ever became patriarch, and he's called the Red Patriarch as a result of this. He was a patriarch when the anti-humans experiments were going on in the Romanian prison system. And they did what all of the communist hierarchs did at the time. They said that Stalin was a gift from God. They said that there was no human rights abuses here, that the prison system is humane, that there needs to be a union with Rome, which was almost their obsession. And they all became a part of the World Council of Churches. The World Council of Churches was a Rockefeller foundation, but it also was a way for the Soviets to use the church to their best potential. That's really the only reason for its existence. Let me quote so-called Patriarch Justinian at the time of Stalin's death. Stalin, the leader of the Communist Party, fulfills the law of history. He acts as God wanted him to act, which is why we must obey him. Humanity can be renewed according to the Soviet model. Therefore, no Christian can oppose this idea. This will create a new man across the planet. Christ is a new man. The new man is Soviet man. Therefore, Christ is Soviet. Now, he's not alone in that kind of nonsense. This is a lot more, in his case at least, it had more to do with the fact that he was already, when he hid George Udej and he escaped from prison, and he went from it, you know, he was a nobody. He went from a nobody to patriarch pretty much overnight. And by the way, Justin and Teoxys were members of the National Assembly, which was a communist ruling body. And Justin went from a priest to patriarch overnight because he was Justinian's protege. Now, I want to remind my Orthodox listeners, these men were in communion with world Orthodoxy. They, in fact, were world Orthodoxy. This is what's called canonical at the time and today. This is the foundation of these churches. These people oversaw the liquidation of Orthodox believers all over the place. They did what they were told. They had no right to be where they were. These three patriarchs came into existence solely because they supported the communist state. They were a part of the destruction of the church there. Teosis actually supported systemization. And when this began, 26 very ancient churches near the capital, suburbs of the capital, were destroyed, he said that was perfectly okay. Then when the revolution broke out, because Teosis, I believe, died in 2007, he said, oh, this isn't legitimate, foreign intelligence is behind it, Ceausescu is a man of God. Patriarch Teosis, who was patriarch under Ceausescu, in 2003 received the William Fliederman Award for good relations with the Jews. Teotis was resigned after the revolution because he said, and he fully admitted, that he was a supporter of the communist government, and in repentance, he needed to resign. A group of hacks claiming to be churchmen called him back and his resignation was not accepted. And they had their own cult of personality, and you still have it today among Orthodox people who talk about how they saved the church from the communists. They'll make a big deal about Theosius, the 500 churches that he helped repair and build. They don't say that that was after the 77 earthquake, or that that was, the fact is that in his period of time, 12,000 churches were destroyed. They don't mention this. Rabbi Moses Rosen, who was the chief rabbi in the country under Ceausescu, when Theosius was patriarch, said that Romania is heaven for the Jews. That's something that these guys also mentioned. This is, when you say canonical orthodoxy, that's who you're talking about. There's no getting out of this. It wasn't just a matter of saving the church. Many of these men were committed communists who believed that somehow Christ wasn't really, had no connection with the spirit whatsoever and was purely, it could be understood in purely material terms. And that's what these guys were saying. And you can't get away from this. This is what happened. Now, at least Theosius resigned with the understanding that, you know, I'm doing this in penance. I'm doing this because I know what I am and I know what I did. This is one of the reasons that in Romania in particular, the old calendar movement, of course, Romania's new calendar, the old calendar movement is so large. I believe it's one of the largest in Eastern Europe. I believe it's at least the same size as the mainline church. And it's very difficult for people. One of the things that's keeping the spiritual explosion of these areas from taking place is that people have a problem connecting themselves with bishops and their successors who were like this. It's really hard to do. It's really hard to take them seriously when you see the character that they had. And again, you had some bishops who went along because they had no choice. We can never judge those people. We don't know what it's like to have a gun pointed to our heads. These guys, especially Justinian, was already a committed communist. And a lot of these guys were. And he created the Red Church. He was called the Red Patriarch. And he created an entire theology based on their support and their love of Stalin and the Soviet Union. So unfortunately, there's really not much to say in that respect. That's not very, very depressing. I just want to reiterate that this is what's considered canonical orthodoxy in the world. These men were active participants in the destruction of Romanian culture, and they never opposed systemization. So, to summarize this, Ceausescu, when he takes over in the late 60s, because of American investment, because of many of his policies, he built by communist standards, a relatively successful economy. But it was irrational and it was unbalanced. By the 1980s, debt was very high, inflation was very high, and the gains made in the 50s and 60s, this capital now was out of date, and there was nothing coming in to replace it. Americans made a quick profit and then left. It was an internationalist system, but at the same time, Ceausescu never left the orbit of the Soviet Union, never had any desire to do so. He was not independent, he was not a national communist, that was nonsense. He never deviated from the Soviet line on anything except the 1968 invasion of Czechoslovakia, which he was never asked to participate in the first place. These were purely symbolic actions. But the investment that poured in from Western sources was not because of his alleged independence, because this occurred before 1968 anyway. That just was an excuse that the Nixon administration used for giving him most favored nation status. Yes, Ceausescu was occasionally an irritant to the Soviets when he came out against the split with China. But when I say irritant, I mean it was probably an eye roll. That was about it. Romania was not a huge part of the Warsaw Pact, militarily speaking. They weren't a part of the 68 invasion of Czechoslovakia because they weren't asked. And most of the Eastern Bloc was against that. The East Germans were against it. They had nothing to do with it either. What makes Romania interesting, that you had this massive growth, then this massive collapse. You had Ceausescu's cult of personality being used to sell off the country, including its oil wealth, to pay down this debt to zero, which he succeeded in doing, but at the cost of everything in the country. What's the point of paying off debt when there's nothing left? Anything of value was sold. When you're importing oil at very high prices, when you are a major oil producer, you know that there's something very irrational in the country. And the Orthodox Church was pretty much irrelevant, except, of course, your old calendar underground movements, which were very relevant. But as far as these bishops and politicians were concerned, they were the hardest core supporters of his system, one of the few supporters of systemization out there, despite the fact that systemization was partially aimed at the church. But the new government that took over didn't do any better in 1990. The National Salvation Front inherited an economy that was already in the advanced stages of collapse. And as always, privatization was hijacked. And what was left of these companies went to an oligarchy connected with the West. Those who already had money and power and who could afford to buy this stuff up and manipulate the system this way. One of the things that brought him down was Elena, her insane claims about herself. Even during the trial, her arrogant demeanor, as she's being tied up, she says to those soldiers, "I was like a mother to you, what are you doing this to me for?" Having absolutely no clue what was going on in the country at the time. And they did live in palaces. You could take a tour of them online right now. But the successes of Ceausescu came from Western investment. And after 1961, it became a way to communicate with the Chinese in a very rational way. Of course, they were trading with China anyway. The claim that Romania is going to be self-sufficient was rhetorical. It was nonsensical. It was never an independent part of the Warsaw Pact. It just wasn't an important part of the Warsaw Pact. So 30 years ago, almost to the day, I decided this is what I was going to do for a living. And I don't regret it. It's been one hell of a 30 years. I remember the very day I made the decision. It was right on Christmas Day when Ceausescu was laying there dead. And I said, "Oh my God, if this is going on, if this empire is crumbling without a war going on," I couldn't articulate it like this, but this was the sense, then I'm living in a world that my fathers and forefathers had no concept of. There's something new coming in here. There's something completely, and this is one of the reasons I got involved in Eastern Europe almost right away. I still have the New York Times front page from when the Soviet Union collapsed. I still have them in my collection when I bought them at the time. It was unbelievably shocking. And it shocked the CIA more than anybody else. So he ended up being one of the most hated men in Romanian history. And he could have been a fairly popular one. Especially, at least when it came to economics. So, thank you everyone for listening. Thank you for those who have known me and supported me for these 30 years of nonstop work, nonstop study, nonstop research. Without a break, without a vacation, without a moment's peace. For those who have supported me, I thank you very much, and I will talk to you next time. Bye-bye.